This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. He's never been on the show before. His name is Michael Robotham and his new book is called Life or Death. It's out from Mulholland Books here in the United States. Hello.
Hi.
There you are. I thought we lost you there for a second.
No, I'm here. Definitely here.
Now, this book is out in the United States. Now, do you have a book currently out in Australia? A newer book, or is this
the same one? This same one. I have a new one coming out in Australia and the UK in August of this year, which is called Close Your Eyes. It won't be out in the States until probably next February or March.
Wow.
So Life or Death is it is my current title right around the world.
How do we get so left out? I feel like we're left out here. They always come out overseas first.
I think this is, no, I am trying to, it's something I'm trying to rectify. It's to get my publishing schedule on the same sort of, at the same date right around the world, it will mean that I probably have to go a year without writing a book. And to give America a chance to sort of catch up. And one of the great problems is that depending on different times of year, and whether it be the Southern Hemisphere or the Northern Hemisphere, you have your big book buying time. So you obviously, the American summer is a great time for people buying a book, but they go on their holiday, and Christmas is a great time. And there are sort of great, there are designated seasons, and it's hard to get the world to sort of agree on a release date, but more and more it's important because with obviously globalization and the internet and I think with Life or Death, a lot of my American readers weren't prepared to wait and they went and accessed the book bought the book from the UK or Canada or Australia.
Well, when they like you, Michael. They want your books and they want them quick. They don't want to wait.
No, that's true. And I think more and more so with technology, and you can see this with TV series, people aren't willing. That's why piracy becomes an issue, because if people are made to wait, they will simply find other means of getting the material. And so nowadays, I think it's very important to try to release books, simultaneously around the world, and to try to release and not that, because people do feel they feel aggrieved if they know elsewhere in the world, people are reading a book that they aren't allowed to buy.
So the premise of this book, which is really tremendous, is why would a guy who's getting out of prison the next day escape the night before? That's the big premise of this book, and that's what made me want to read it. I've read that. That sounds interesting. I got to see what's going on in this kind of a story. And that's all. It's all about story and characters to me. I mean, it has to be a good story, and it has to be believable characters. If you don't have both, I don't think it works.
No, I completely agree. I think some people mistakenly believe that even when it comes to the crime genre, that it's somehow plot-driven, and I think that it's equally as much character-driven. It doesn't matter how good the story is, if the characters aren't compelling, if you don't actually like them or they don't engage you and you're not concerned about their fate, then there's very little that's going to drive you to continue watching it. I mean, we've all been in that situation of reading a book or watching a show, and we suddenly realize we don't care about any of the characters. We don't care if they get the girl, don't get the girl, whether they catch the criminal or don't catch, we just don't care. Yeah. And that's the moment we turn it off or we put the book down.
And it's interesting because I read a lot of mysteries, very serious mysteries, and when I read a mystery that doesn't take the mystery seriously, I kind of get annoyed sometimes. And even though there are a lot of funny mysteries out there, if they don't take the mystery seriously, it turns me off a lot of times, and I want it to be taken seriously. Somebody gets murdered, that's a serious thing, it's not like... It's not like something to laugh about, but it's interesting how that is. I mean, Lillian Jackson Braun, when she wrote those Cat Who books, they always seem to be ridiculous. I mean, the cats would solve the mysteries. I mean, come on, whose cat's going to solve a mystery? I mean, and they're cute.
It's a broad church in this sort of, the genre is a broad church, and there are the sort of cozy or the cat solving, or the knitting circle crime books and all sorts of very gentle gentle books, and then there are the hard-boiled. And I guess I agree with you, but it's such a broad church, and people find what they enjoy, you know. And there are some books out there that you read but don't inhale, in the sense that they are, you know, that you put them down and within about 10 minutes you've forgotten that you've even read them because they had so little impact upon you. And there are other books that stay with you for days and weeks afterwards, because they had such a tremendous impact. And you know, this is one of the great beauties of writing in the genre.
And this, what the book that I read of yours, with authors that I really like, there's always that one book that really got me hooked on the author. And with you, it was a book called Say You're Sorry, an unbelievably good book. I read that when I was sick one, and I think I wrote to you by email and explained this to you. But I was sick one, it was New Year's Eve, and I read this book. I could not put the book down. Even though I was feeling horrible, I still wanted to read this book. That's how powerful that book was.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it's enormously flattering. It, you know, and I think that's all you can ask for with, you know, when you're writing, is that idea of people either when they finish the book wanting to press it in the hand of someone else saying you must read this, or they want to go out and find something else that you've written. And Say Your Story was an interesting book in a sense because, you know, it was written several years ago now, but you know, the events that in Cleveland of a year or two ago, when, you know, the three women were discovered, you know, imprisoned in the house for 10 years.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In Cleveland, I mean, I remember the book came out. I think it was came out in paperback in the States just about around that time that those women were freed, and there were so many parallels between the two books that people. I mean, it is one of those sort of weird circumstances.
I probably thought you had done it.
You know, yeah, well, fiction begins to mirror the truth. You know, where you realize you've written the book, and suddenly, you know, it is fiction, but it suddenly events sort of catch up with it, and you realize that the truth is mirrored what you've written.
Right, exactly. There's something about that book, and I feel the same way about a lot of different books that I've read, but that one really, really hit me hard as far as just the story was just so spectacular. I mean, why does a book grab your attention? Why do you pick up a book, and why do you continue reading it? Is it the style of writing? Is it the character?
What you said, yeah, I think it's what you said earlier. It's a bit like, that, well, I think initially that hook, it's, you mentioned life or death and that hook of, you know, why would a man escape from prison the day before he was due to be released? And, I mean, that was, the seed of that idea was a true story. I read in May of 1995, so 20 years ago, I read a 2-paragraph story about a man who escaped from prison the day before he was due to be released. It was just a tiny newspaper article. And it intrigued me, you know, and I kept thinking, why? And it took me for years. I just tossed it around in my head saying, why would someone do that? And I knew that there was a story in there somewhere that I could make a novel, you know, out of that. But it took me a long while to come up with a reason, to do it. But that was, I think it's initially a hook like that that grabs the reader in. And then it's writing characters that people care about. In the case of Life or Death, it's, you know, Audie Palmer. You know, it opens with him escaping from prison the day before he's due to be released, and the reader's got to care about the character. It's got to be engaged in their fate, and really, you know, even if you're not sure whether he's guilty or he's innocent, but you still care about what happens to him. And I think that's what sets it apart. I mean, when you ask, particularly even in crime writing, if you ask people to name what their favorite ever crime novel is, and then you say, okay, what's it about? They'll begin telling you about the characters. They won't tell you long after they've forgotten the intricacies of the plot. It's the characters they remember, and it's the characters that bring readers back to a particular writer again and again and again.
Well, you write different characters every book. You don't have you ever had the same character more than once?
Yeah, no, with Say You're Sorry, Say You're Sorry is part of a sort of a loose series that features the same psychologist, Joseph O'Loughlin. You know, and his.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think I think Life or Death is my 10th novel, and I think there have been about 4 or 5 novels where Joe is either a minor character or the major character, and so initially what I decided to do with my first 3 novels, which were The Suspect, Lost, and The Night Ferry, was I took. There were a minor character, and each book became the main character in the next one. So all it was. was a very loose series. It wasn't like having a regular character so much as having a cast of characters. And to a degree, that's still the case. I periodically pick on a small character, you know, which is possible for a future novel that one of the characters in life or death, you know, there's a wonderful FBI agent, Desiree in there who, you know, who knows, I might find a story where she could turn up again in some future book.
Right, that's what sort of like Tana French does with hers. She's got some, like a murder squad, and she just focuses on a different character each time, but it's sort of the same thing, only her characters aren't really minor. They're all part of that same group, so they're all pretty much evenly popular. So, but that...
Yeah, it's one of, I think I suppose I wanted to compromise a little bit. I mean, readers love series characters. They love it when they pick up a book. It's like when someone picks up, let's say, a Lee Child, and they sort of know they're with it, like Jack Reacher's there. It's like being with an old friend. You sit down, you know what you're going to get. And readers find great comfort in that. I actually think that, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily give readers what they want. You actually shake it up and you give them something new, which is why Life or Death was so important for me to write a standalone like that. But I think, my big fear is that I didn't want to get bored and I didn't want to write the same book twice. By writing the same character book after book after book, you know, you sometimes run the risk of, you know, even the reader, even a huge fan will say, yeah, I enjoyed it, but it was a bit like the last one. You know, there's, I never want to write the same book twice. When that happens, I want someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, Michael, it's about time you hung up the pencil and the pad.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be. I mean, nobody wants to read a book that's like another book. Everything to be fresh and new. And that's how I feel. I mean, Lee Child does it so well. I mean, every book is fresh and exciting. I mean, I you wonder how he does it. You wonder how all any authors do it. I mean, it's not an easy task. You have to sit down and come up with
idea. And there are examples. I mean, yeah, there are examples. I mean, I won't name them now, but there are examples of writers who probably should have pensioned off their main character, you know, a while back, because it does appear, you know, sometimes you hear readers talk about the writer having posted that one in. You know, they feel as though that the writer's sort of given up a bit and they're not trying hard enough to keep it fresh. And I agree that, you know, people like Lee Child and Ian Rankin, the wonderful British writer who writes the Rebus series, I mean, they're amazingly good at keeping it incredibly fresh for book after book. But, you know, you've got to be, as I say, it takes an enormous amount of skill. And sometimes you can see writers that seem to have almost fallen out of love with their main character and they're just going through the motions. And they're the ones that should come up with a new character and a new direction to make it fresh and exciting for them.
Well, Audie is such an unusual character. I mean, I can see Audie being in another book, but I mean, I don't know that he's meant to be in another book, but he's such an unusual character. I mean, we watch what he does and we think, well, is he being stupid or what? Does the man have no brain or what? But we somehow know there's more to it than what we think there is. And that's what makes this book interesting.
Sort of, in a sense, there's a bit of a Shawshank Redemption vibe going to Life or Death. And in many ways, yeah, Audie at times feels like a passive character that all these things are happening to, but he's not reacting. But in fact, you know, you're right, he has got a plan. All the way along, he's had a plan, but the reader has to sort of slowly unpack what that plan is.
And, are you as smart as Audie?
And, yeah, well, I think I don't have his sense of fortitude. The idea that he could spend 10 years in prison enduring the most horrendous sort of abuse and hardship, you know, because everyone wants to know what happened to the missing millions that he you know, allegedly stole, you know, and that he would go through such hardship when a lot of people would simply have given up. No, I think he's clever and he's got... But it's like so many things. Whenever we read those stories about tremendous acts of bravery and courage, and a lot of us think, God, we could never do that. But it's not until you're put in that situation that you realize what you are capable of doing. And those hidden sort of, you know, those hidden strengths we have and that desire to survive, that, you know, helps us sort of get through those moments. And I think Audie has those things. And I think, like a lot of my characters, it's like the Joe O'Loughlin character, psychologist from, you mentioned, Say You're Sorry. Yeah. These are sort of, yeah, there's probably a little wish fulfillment there. I'd like to be as clever as they are and as, you know, as witty as they are. And, that's the beauty of being a writer. I can live vicariously through my characters.
Yeah, that's really cool. And to be able to sit down, and when you first sit down and write a book, I mean, how do all these thoughts come to you? And where do they come from? And how do you organize them into a coherent and an interesting novel? I mean, that's the hard part. I mean, it's easy to come up with an idea, but to get that idea into a story that makes perfect sense is not easy at all.
I think it's one of those things that you come up with the idea, and sometimes, Stephen King, I don't plan my books or plot the books in advance, so I just come up with a hook of an idea, and then my characters, and then I just almost think, well, what would happen next, and what might happen now, and it's almost the point to say, well, what would be the worst thing that happens next, and have that happen. Stephen King once liked me. You never know when you come up with an idea whether it's going to be, have the weight, the depth, or the possibilities to be a novel, or whether it's just a great short story idea. Stephen King said it's like walking along and seeing a bone sticking out of the ground, and you begin scraping away the dirt, and you don't know if it's going to be a dog bone or a dinosaur. And you sort of, if it's a dinosaur, then there's a novel there, but if it's a dog bone, then it's nothing. So it's a case of coming up with these ideas and exploring them a little bit. Okay, and you know, I throw enormous amounts of material away, and a hell of a lot of ideas away. They just don't turn into anything. I write myself off a cliff, or you know, I don't give myself enough. You know, I always hate it. If I reach a process in a novel where I can only see one avenue to escape where I am, one possible thread, that terrifies me, because what if that thread leads me off a cliff or into a dead end? I like being at any stage of the novel having, you know, as many as 8 or 9 or 10 different things. You know, I could have, in some way, Say You're Sorry, I got to the penultimate chapter of that, and it could have been one of six, the killer, or the villain could have been one of six people, and I didn't know which one it was going to be.
Right.
Until the penultimate chapter. And I had a favorite in my mind of who I wanted it to be, but I thought...
Well, how do you leave clues then?
So it could be anyone's... Well, look, you go back. Once you make it possible that any one of those six people could have done it, okay, and then when you've decided who it's going to be, you just go back and finesse a few more clues.
Okay.
Not too many. You've got to give the reader a good chance, but you don't give them... You certainly don't beam, you know, give them no chance at all, because readers get very cross if you've given them no chance to solve the puzzle. They also get a little annoyed if you made it too easy to solve the puzzle. So that's that delicate balancing act. And I often think that, you know, I don't put enough clues in, and I have an editor come back saying, I think you've got to give the reader a bit more of a chance to pick this. So
they really look into it that much. Wow.
Yeah. It is a bit like, you know, it's a bit like something John Irving was always very good in his novels doing, is the ability to plant a clue where it's like being a magician, where you just distract someone look at my right hand because I'm planting the clue with my left hand, sort of thing, that sort of conjuring trick. But you're planting it and the reader is seeing you do it, but you've managed to actually distract them enough that they remember that what happens is when it's like planting it, burying a landmine, and the reader watches you do it, but they still step on it later and go, oh my God, I should have seen that, because I saw him do it, but I didn't realize it was important, you know.
Now, how many countries are your books published in?
I mean, to translate it into 22 languages.
Wow.
I think other than English, 23 foreign languages, and,
there's quite the broad appeal then.
And yeah, no, I think it's, I mean, my biggest markets are actually in Europe, you know, in Germany and the Netherlands and places like that, where I'm probably better known in Germany than I am anywhere else in the world. It's a very odd thing to be sitting here in Australia and setting books in Britain and in America, but being better known in Germany than I am in my own backyard. But that's the great beauty of writing.
Yeah, I just get annoyed. When I pick up a book and I don't like it, I kind of get annoyed and I think, why don't I like this book? What is it about this book that I don't like? Why can't I read it? Why do I put it down? Why can't I put it down and not care about it a day later? And then others I pick up and I instantly get into the story. And it's a trick. It's not easy to do. And a lot of writers haven't mastered that trick as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, I read some great ones. Michael Connelly, I think of Michael Connelly. How he gets me into the story. Just, I always love reading Michael Connelly's books. And I know you do too, because I know you've met
him. Yeah, no, it's funny. I do too. I've just finished. I'm actually interviewing Michael Connelly next Wednesday. Day in Sydney. He's there at the Sydney Writers Festival.
Wow.
We've got to share a stage. Now, Michael, I think he's, again, the classic example that we mentioned earlier of someone who's managed to maintain a character like Harry Bosch, and the books are still wonderfully fresh.
Somebody who could have been very dull very quickly, but has still not become dull. After all these years, we still are interested in Harry. What's going to happen to Harry? I mean, and we really, as we're reading, and the trick is, as you're reading the book, you're really not sure that something really horrible is not going to happen to Harry. And sure enough, something did the last
book. I know,
book,
it's so. One of those things. It is one of those things that you've, that's that ability to sort of, again, to create suspense, to create a character that everyone cares about, and then to have that undercurrent of suspense where the reader is on tenterhooks, worrying about, the people that you want them to worry about. It works when it's done well. And Michael is one of the, pound for pound, one of the best crime writers, in the world, because he is so consistent. Because everyone, a lot of writers, I think you've got to accept that they're going to occasionally write a book that doesn't it doesn't appeal to you as much as some of their previous works. But Michael is just so solid. He just does not produce a bad book.
Yeah, it is. It's just you realize how much talent they have. I mean, you think to yourself, well, I could write a book. And then you start to think about, well, what would my idea be? And then you realize that it's not as simple as you think it is. It's not as simple as just your hand doesn't start writing. You have to think ahead of time what you're going to write and how you're going to sound. And you read it back to yourself and you think, oh, that sounds stupid. And before you know it, you realize how difficult it really is.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, It's like teaching someone to ride is like teaching someone to ride a bike, in a sense that you can talk about it, you can try to explain to someone verbally how to ride a bike, but until they get on that bike and start to pedal and make all those thousands of little adjustments in balance, they'll never learn. You can't talk them into riding a bike. They have to actually do it. And riding's the same. And some people, in the end, you can't even teaching it, you can't tell someone when to put one word in front of another or why one paragraph works better in front of the next one. That's something that's just inside the writer. They make those decisions hundreds of times a day.
Now you're
and then through all the rewrites.
Right. Life or Death, I found, wasn't as dark as Say You're Sorry was. I mean, am I wrong about that, or it doesn't seem as dark?
No, I think it's a different style. I think Say You're Sorry is a very suffocating psychological thriller, and I think most of my books have been that. They're labeled psychological thrillers.
Well, what is it? What do you go through?
Sorts of books.
Yeah. I'm wondering what your mindset is, or what your mood is while you're writing a book like Say You're Sorry. I mean, are you feeling dark too, or do you have to go to a dark place to write that book?
Yeah, no, I think particularly because that's true because I don't plot the books in advance. When you reach a certain process in the story, when your main character is in enormous danger, I'm with them, and I don't sleep during those days and weeks. I mean, I feel for them. It's like leaving someone dangling on the edge of a cliff, and you can't think about anything else until you actually rescue them. And so it is. Another book actually called Shatter, which came before Say You're Sorry, which is even darker again. And a very pure psychological thriller, in the sense that it's not about body counts or none of my books are about body counts or gore or terrible things. They're the sort of books that, basically, if you're reading alone at night, and the phone rings, you sort of hit the roof thinking, and you're suddenly getting up to check that the doors are locked. That sort of, but Shatter was written partly, half the story is told from the point of view of a villain. and in first person, so inhabiting his skin, I found very disturbing, and that was probably the most disturbing thing I've ever had to do as a writer. And I actually said to myself after that I would never go that psychologically dark again, but then in Say You're Sorry I went back into that sort of territory. Whereas, you know, you're right about life or death being different. It's more your classic man on the run thriller as opposed to a psychological thriller. You know, it's a different style of book.
It's like, I think of Thomas Harris when I think of really disturbing novels. I mean, nothing's more disturbing than Hannibal and Silence of the Lambs. And I mean, they're really, really, really disturbing books. You have to wonder, what kind of a man is Thomas Harris?
And yet, you're absolutely right. But yet, even in Say You're Sorry, there's one scene in Say You're Sorry, which I won't give any spoilers away. There's one scene which I got a little people pushing back, saying that was very gruesome, this scene. But in fact, I didn't describe the scene. It was off camera. What happened was I described people's reaction to something that it's when the pathologist is examining a body. And so it's just their reactions. So you never see anything happen to this person. You only see people's reactions to it. But a lot of people reading it were really disturbed by that and claimed that I'd gone too far. And I tried to point out to them that in fact their imagination had gone there. To that place. I hadn't written anything like that. And I think my stuff is not sort of even a book like Shatter, it's all about the power of the mind to create the monsters. I don't have sort of torture scenes. I don't do sort of like Thomas Harris does in terms of, you know, people having skin ripped off them or all sorts of things. I've never written a book like that. I deal more in the monsters that we ourselves create in our minds.
Is there any interest in making your books into films, or have there been any films of your books?
Yeah, well, it's at the moment there's a lot of interest in Life or Death, and the film
really?
Film rights are being negotiated in the States at the moment, and the Germans have made the first two Jo O'Loughlin books into films and intend to make several more.
And, are we going to see them in the United States?
The same sort of German. Yeah, well, they're the same German production team and Mob that did sort of shows like The Killing and The Bridge, which turned up in the States and also were turned into US series as well. So, you know, you never know how these things go. And there's the BBC and a few other people are negotiating to do the books as well. You never hold your breath over stuff like this because, you know, at one point there last year I had a premium, one of the big premium cable sort of networks interested in the books as well, and like over the past sort of 10 or 15 years there have been I've discovered after many options being taken out that these things take a long time. You know, my previous career was as a journalist and as a ghostwriter, and I ghostwrote a book which took 17 years to be made into a film called Oranges and Sunshine. So you realize that this when it comes to film, it is a very slow process, and you never hold your breath.
Well, what did you think of the actor who played Jo O'Loughlin?
In the German film,
what was your first reaction when you saw him?
It was interesting. I was in Hamburg last year in Germany, and there were 700 people there, and it was at a screening of the show, and I had the two lead actors on either side of me watching the screening. And for 700 sort of people after I'd done a book event, which was a wonderful experience. No, I think he was, it's really interesting, a nice story. In Germany, when you tour, you travel with a German actor who does your readings for you. And this particular actor that I toured with several years earlier, and he'd done all my audiobooks in German, he actually won the role to play Jo O'Loughlin in the film. So I knew the actor who was actually going to play Jo. And I was, which I thought was lovely, and I think he did a very fine job. And the character of Vincent Ruiz, who is a sort of the sidekick, a former detective, I think they chose a much younger actor in Germany to play the role, and initially I was quite concerned by that. But this actor absolutely ate up the screen. I mean, every scene he was in, he just sort of dominated. He's one of those incredibly watchable people that you, And so I think it worked really well, and hence the fact they've made a second, and they're filming the third films because the first one did so well.
That's great. That's good. I had no idea you had films already with your books. And a lot of authors get to the point where nobody seems to want me. I was talking to, I can't remember his name now. Matthew Riley it was. And he's from Australia, actually.
Yeah.
And he was talking.
Yes, I know Matthew. Yep.
He was talking about how none of his books have been filmed yet, and he just wrote a book about dragons, like Jurassic Park with dragons, and it's a fascinating book, and I'm thinking, well, somebody's got to have an interest in this. I mean, and it just seemed like such an interesting subject.
Matthew's big problem is he admits himself as that his books are such those high-concept, big-budget sort of films.
Right.
That it was very expensive to make. I mean, we're talking, you know, 100 million plus to make those, and there's only a handful of those films made in any given year. I think it's probably easier if he was writing more those sort of, I mentioned those sort of domestic psychological thrillers. You know, you can do it on a smaller budget. You've probably got more chance of getting it made. And that's the problem with it. You know, as Matthew said, when you start blowing up aircraft carriers or having massive zoos for dragons, then it's going to cost a lot of money to make.
Right. It's nice to see your books are in 22 countries. That's a huge amount of countries all over the world. I mean, you wonder how there's so many authors out there. You wonder how they all survive. I mean, how do people find out about these wonderful books? I mean, there's a lot of wonderful books that nobody ever hears about. If I went to work tomorrow and said my name.
That's very true. And that's very true. I'm very fortunate because I have got the international markets and I can make a good living as a writer. But you know, the vast majority of writers, as you know, I mean, they struggle in obscurity. And it'd be lovely to think that the cream always rises to the top. But you know, the truth of the matter is that there are some incredibly fine books and some wonderful writers who never receive the recognition that they deserve. There's a degree of luck involved in this business that, you know, being discovered, getting that right review at the right time. I mean, you look at someone like, you know, classic as Harlan Coben, you know, got a tremendous break when Bill Clinton was seen getting off the Air Force One helicopter in the White House, coming back from Camp David with a Harlan Coben book tucked under his arm, and the world suddenly turned around and said, who is this Harlan Coben guy?
And suddenly his
sales went through the roof. You know, it can be the smallest little thing that can be the trigger that finally sees you.
So let that be a lesson. Try to force your book into Bill Clinton's hands or somebody. Obama's.
There you go. What you need is just
find out when Obama's going to be at that bookstore next time.
Need to throw it in scene. It's a bit like, you know, as I say, you know, it's like the Oprah Winfrey effect or anything like that. It's that little endorsement, that little, as you say, whether it be made into a film or some celebrity be seen reading it or whatever, that's what it can sometimes take. And you know, but at the end of the day, if the book's no good, it's not going to take off, because you know, the little celebrity sort of endorsement might get you recognised and might get people buying it, but the only thing that turns it into a big seller is word of mouth. You know,
well, it's like,
it's got to be a good book.
There's an author that I'm reading now, and I won't mention her name because I don't want to embarrass her, but her first book was absolutely tremendous. I read it when I went over to a friend's house, and it was so good I got up in the middle of the night to finish it, and it was so compelling and it was so spectacular. And now I'm reading her second book, and it's just not grabbing me yet. It's just not doing anything for me. And I think to myself, why is that? Why can I love one book and not love the next one? What did they do different? I mean, why isn't it the same kind of greatness? But it's almost like,
I think that's because, you know, that's the nature. It's interesting. A literary writer can be recognized for one book in their entire career. You know, one book, if it's a good enough book, you know, wins awards, wins a Pulitzer or a National Book Awards or whatever. You know, that one book will define their entire career. When you're writing genre fiction like we are, you're only as good as your last one, mm-hmm. and you're judged on your body of work. You know, and the truth of the matter is that, you know, it's a huge expectation in a sense to think that someone, if they've written one brilliant book, they're going to keep writing brilliant books. You know, it's not through lack of trying. I'm sure they're trying. And the other issue actually is logistical one. If it's a first novel, often it could have been 7 years in the writing, 7 years of part-time work, 7 years of thought, and suddenly they get it published, and a publisher turns around and says, okay, but we want another book in 12 months. And as a writer, you think, okay, I can do that. But, you know, all that 7 years you took with the first one, that was important. And suddenly, I think what sets writers, you know, quality writers apart from those, you know, who can just do one or two good books is the ability to book after book produce the goods, you know, in when they're writing a book every year or a book every 2 years.
You look at Harper Lee, he's only ever published one book, you know.
That's right. And so it's, you know, simple fact of the matter is that often second books are rushed, you know, and you can read a brilliant first novel and the second book has been rushed through because people don't want to leave it too long and have readers forget who this person is. Mm-hmm. And second novels don't match up to the first, you know, or they fall into that sophomore syndrome or second novel syndrome that we talk about. So I think it's, you know, often, and that's why it's interesting. I have readers tell me that, you know, they pick up my book. They might not have read one of my books until I'd written five or six. Mm-hmm. And it's almost so they said, we wanted to wait to see whether you had the legs to last, you know, whether we didn't want to get involved and if you weren't going to be able to be one of our regulars, if you know what I mean. And they didn't bother reading me until they saw that I'd had four or five books out there. And then they thought, okay, now we'll give you a try. And then they went back and read all of them.
Right. And now it reminds me of like a TV show. When you watch a TV show and you know it's going to be canceled, and you think, well, why should I keep watching it if I know it's going to end next week? I mean, it just seems pointless. You know,
exactly.
Why should I get involved in
exactly.
so involved
and that's
in?
Why,
it?
I'm yeah, sorry. No, that's and some people that's exactly what they say. They say, look, I'm already really involved in four or five series that I watch. I don't want to get involved in another one. You know, and you know, unless you know, it's got to be really good. They've got to heard the word from people, you know, and then they think, okay, I'll buy the box set or I'll go back and watch it from the beginning. But by the same token, it's a bit like, you know, some people will look at a long-running series, you know, and they'll go, if they've never read a Lee Child or an Ian Rankin or something, and they'll go, it's almost intimidating. They think, well, hold on. Or even a Michael Connelly. If they've never read Harry Bosch, they think, well, there's now been, you know, 18 Harry Bosch novels. And a lot of people think, no, I have to start at the beginning. I can't just pick up the new one.
Yeah.
And, do I have to go back and read all those books? And so they actually avoid someone like Michael Connelly because, you know, it's like there's too many books to read if you haven't read him before. And you and I both know that you can pick up any one of them. They're standalones. So you don't have to have read the previous novels to enjoy a Michael Connelly.
Exactly. Exactly. I wonder... As you're writing, say you're sorry. Did you know you had something really great? Did you sense it while you were writing it? It had to be something because it's such a spectacular book. I mean, it's a standout book. It's not just a really good book. It's a really great book. And I wonder, as you're writing it, whether you felt that, or whether you felt that with Life or Death or any of your books.
No, it's interesting. I mean, my entire writing career has been predicated on the belief that each novel is going to be the novel that exposes me as a fraud and that I don't really know what I'm doing. And so I deliver each book convinced. I actually sign each copy of a new book to my agent saying I've fooled them again, you know, that they think I know what I'm doing here. You know, I have favorites and I have books which I think, you know, Say You're Sorry is one of the best books I've managed to put together. I think that and probably Shatter and Watching You, they're three really good, you know, good psychological thrillers. And you know, I think there aren't too many weaknesses in stories. I can't point to them saying there's too much I'd want to change. But at the time of writing, I'm always convinced that, you know, it's going to be appalling, you know, that I can't make this work, you know, because, you know, through Say You're Sorry, I thought, you know, I didn't know who the villain was going to be until the very end. I didn't know whether I could bring the story together until, as I said, the last chapter. And it was always, it's more a moment, a feeling of relief rather than triumph when it succeeds.
I think with Say You're Sorry, it's what really makes that book effective is the diary. There's a diary with the kidnapped woman who we get to see what she's feeling all through this story, the horror of what it feels like to be kidnapped. I mean, there's all of that running through this book, and it's just fantastic. I mean, it's just, wow.
It's the dual narrative of, you hear from Piper Hadley. She's a 17-year-old girl or 18-year-old girl, and she's been missing 3 years. So you hear from her, and you're never quite sure when you first start hearing from Piper's diary whether it's a bit like a Lovely Bones moment where maybe she's dead, and this is a diary of a girl that didn't survive, and you don't quite know when you begin reading her diary if she's alive or dead. And then, so it's her story in captivity, and then it's the story of Joe O'Loughlin, the psychologist that becomes convinced, because the police have sort of given up on this and they think that, you know, she's a runaway or she's dead. It's Joe O'Loughlin that is convinced that she's still alive, and it becomes the hunt to find her. And it's the two stories that interweave, which I think is, yeah, that's why the book becomes so effective.
Have you ever worked on two books at once?
No. That's terrifying. No, I see what I've done though is the amount of times that I start a book and write 40,000 words and think, nah, and I start a new one. And I think at the moment, the book that I'm going to write next, I think I'm on my third. I started three different books so far. So Close Your Eyes will be the next one, but the book after, which I'm writing now, because Close Your Eyes has been delivered and it's been edited and it'll come out later this year. But the one I'm writing now, yeah, I've had three attempts and I've completely different ideas. I started off setting one in America again, and I changed that, and I started off setting one, you know, completely different book again, setting it in Cornwall in England, and now I've changed that again. So that's what happens. But I know never more than one at the same time. But I reach a point in the process where at least I settle on what I'm going to write. And then, normally it's a point of no return. When I look at my deadlines and think, actually, I have to make a decision here, Michael. You know, make a decision because you're running out of time.
Right. Now, what did your wife think of Close Your Eyes? I'm curious. You always tell me how I remember you told me she loved watching you. She thought that was even better than Say You're Sorry. What did she think about Close Your Eyes?
No, she really liked it. I think there were elements of it where, there are elements of this story without giving too much away. Someone very close to Joe O'Loughlin, doesn't survive in Close Your Eyes. And there's always that point of time. It's a bit like there's that scene in Life or Death when there's quite a shocking scene, where, you know, a couple of people die when you've really got to know them.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
And I remember my wife reading that and coming, storming out to my office and saying, bring them back, you bastard, bring them back.
Yeah, exactly. And she's right. I know exactly who she's talking about, and it is a pretty surprising. I thought that to myself. I thought, well, why would he do that? What is the point of that?
But I think that was the point in the novel. There's a point in the novel you have to raise the stakes. People have to realize that Audie Palmer, he isn't on some sort of, you know, he isn't some joyride here, that, you know, dangerous people want him silenced. And you've got to realize that it's, you know, that how high the stakes are. So it was necessary, I think, for me to write a scene where straight away the reader is reminded that, this is a high stakes game.
That's what
Audie is running for his life here, because these people are not going to let him survive.
Right. And that's what happens in Elizabeth George's book with Lindley, when his significant other gets killed off. It's like, whoa. And people still haven't forgiven her for that. And it's like, that's...
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
But, I mean,
it's a dangerous thing to do as a writer. It is a dangerous thing to do as a writer, but sometimes you've got to... Yeah, sometimes it's for the long-term good of the character, because you've got to talk to yourself, how much further can I take this character? You know, are the books going to start getting very, are they going to begin to sort of read a bit the same? You know, and how can I really shake up their lives and embark on a new chapter where they have longevity, where you can see there are future novels with them? Sometimes that means getting rid of a major character.
But and that's what happens in real life too. I mean, there are things that happen to people that change them forever. But, and it does, you know, in somebody dying, yep, something happening, you know, that'll change that person forever. And that's what I was thinking in the book. I think, well, now that you've done that to the character, that character's never going to be the same way again. Never. And it's scary.
No, and that's true, but it's a bit like that whole element of, you know, one of the things that, you know, has to occur in any great novel, and particularly a crime novel, is what's known as a character arc, in the sense that your character cannot be the same at the end of the novel as they are at the beginning. If they go through all this hardship, all this pain, all this investigation, they, even if at the end of the day they succeed or they win out or they've solved the crime, they must be changed by what they've witnessed and what they've experienced. They've got to be damaged or changed in some way. Because that's life, as you say. That's what happens to all of us. We are changed by circumstances.
Right. I think you were talking about Harlan Coben earlier, and the great thing about Harlan Coben is he can write a really great thriller, but he has a lot of really cool humor in his books too. I mean, you laugh out loud at some of the stuff that happens in his books. I mean, he's got it. That combination of seriousness and funniness really works. It's really effective with him. I mean, there's just things you really laugh out loud about.
Very true. It's one of the things I try to do in my books as well, because particularly, you know, if they're dark psychological thrillers, or even something like Life or Death. I mean, the Moss Webster character in that has some of the best lines, because you want to, even though there are some dark scenes and the reader is on the edge of their seat, you've got to give them a chance to relax, and laughter is a great way to get them to relax. Mm-hmm. To just let the heart rate settle down a bit, and then you start ratcheting the tension up again.
Well, writing comedy, I mean, look at Janet Ivanovich, who has, like, what, 22 books with Stephanie Plum? I mean, and everyone has to be funny, because that's what people expect. They want to laugh while they're reading those books. And do you think...
I'm in awe of Janet Ivanovich, because it's one thing, you know, it's one thing for someone like Harlan and I to want to have a few, to have some really nice one-liners and humour in there, to occasionally to break it up, but to actually write a book which is supposed to be funny, that people pick up expecting. When I have a good line, like there's a line in Bombproof, which is one of my novels, where the character Vincent Ruiz is still having a relationship with his ex-wife. You know, he still has sex with benefits with his ex-wife. And he says at one point, the sex is so good, even the neighbours have a cigarette afterwards.
Right.
and it's a light sort of lines like that sort of work. But they're one line is in a dramatic book. Janet Ivanovich, you know, she's got to be funny from page one all the way through.
Now, what year did you start writing? Did you officially start your first book? What year was it?
Officially started, I think, probably my first novel with the subject of a bidding war at the London Book Fair in 2002. I'd written 117 pages, and it triggered a bidding war and was sold into, I think, about 16 languages on the one day. I think I had about 5 American publishers bidding and 4 German publishers bidding, and it just sort of went off, as they say. And that was that was 2002. I still had to finish that novel, and it came out in early 2004. That was The Suspect.
Right.
And
sometimes it's all about timing, too. It's all about that when the book comes out. I mean, it can be a really timely book or something that people really...
It can be, and I think it's getting oxygen. You know, that was... I don't know why that triggered such a bidding war, because, you know, on a part manuscript. But that generated its own publicity. So, you know, when the book came out, you know, it got reviewed extensively because, you know, it had caused such a fuss when it was sold. And so all of that sort of plays in. You're absolutely right. It's, as I mentioned earlier about, you know, with Say You're Sorry having parallels to, you know, the events in Cleveland, Ohio. I mean, all of those things, it can be a matter of freak timing, if there was a formula, you know, every novel out there would be a big hit. And, everyone would love the formula, but there is none.
I must say, in all honesty, that what really annoys me sometimes is writers that have co-writers as if to say that it's not enough for them to write the book. They have to have somebody helping them do it. I always find that annoying for some reason. Because when I like an author, I don't want somebody else to write with that author. I want to read that one author's books. I don't want there to be two writers for one book. I don't know how you feel about that, but I find that annoying.
Yeah, no, that does annoy me. And, obviously, with all respect to James Patterson, who was a remarkable storyteller, I still feel very uncomfortable with the fact that he has all these ghostwriters who are writing the books and writing his ideas. I think the other thing that annoys me is that, it's hard enough for new writers to get recognized and to get their break. When you have a situation where all these long dead writers, like Ian Fleming and, Conan Doyle, all of these novels now being written by modern day writers are asked to write a new Sherlock Holmes or a new Ian Fleming Bond book, or a new Jason Bourne sort of thriller. And you're thinking, okay, so as a writer now, you're not only competing with all the other writers out there, but you're competing with all the long dead writers who are having new novels published all the time.
Yeah, it's like
that's tough.
And it's hard to write a good Sherlock Holmes novel. I mean, you read them and they're just, they have to be perfect. They have to seem like, or why bother? I mean, people want to feel what they felt when they read Arthur Conan Doyle, and that's difficult. It's the same kind of feeling. Yeah.
They are what they are. I mean, these people wrote what they wrote. It's a bit like, you'd be horrified if people came and rewrote them now because, so the whole idea that, there are even new Agatha Christie's being done now. And you're thinking, well, Agatha Christie wrote what she wrote. That was her body of work. Why should there be new books with an Agatha Christie byline on them coming out now, when she has obviously had nothing to do with writing them?
Exactly. I mean, how would you feel if somebody was writing your book? Say you started a book and then somebody else finished it and published it. Wouldn't that make you feel uncomfortable?
Oh, no, it'd be horrible. Well, it's a bit like, there are now, my publishers, they know if I could write two books a year, they'd be very, very happy. But for me to write two books a year, I'd have to hire someone to write them for me.
Yeah.
And I would never do that. I would just be simply unwilling to do it. Publishers don't mind. It's for them. It's a business, But from my point of view, no. If it's got my name on it, readers can, whether they like it or not, I will have written every word of it. They can be assured of that.
And I read like Charles Todd, and I wonder, and I try to figure out, which one did Charles write? Which one did Carolyn write? And I try to figure out who wrote which part of the book, and I can never figure out. They do it so well that you never really can tell who's writing what part of the book. It doesn't have a different feel all through the book. It's got the same feel throughout the whole book. And that's amazing when you think about it. I mean,
that's interesting because I know that it's about Nikki French, is a husband and wife collaboration. And, I think that'd be my ultimate nightmare. I think, it'd be different if one person was helping with the ideas and just a single person was doing the writing. But the idea that you're doing one chapter, one doing the next, I mean, that would be so difficult. Surely there would be a difference in writing style.
Yeah, you would. I mean, it's like Stephen King. Nobody could write like Stephen King. Nobody. I mean, if I can pick up a book and tell you right away whether it's Stephen King writing it. I mean, if he tried to get somebody else, it wouldn't work. It just would not work. Because his style is so peculiar. It's something that we know, and having read as many Stephen King books as I have, and it's got to be over 30 by now. I don't even know how many he has, but I know what they feel like, and I know what they're going to be like. And if they're not like that, I would certainly know that right away.
Yeah, I think it's to do with, another way it comes down to be like people that try to write like Raymond Chandler, and it does come across as parody, because they can't. Chandler was so good at what he did that if you try to write like him, it feels like you're just parodying rather than, and you can see it, it's obvious.
I remember when Robert Goldsboro was writing the Nero Wolfe books, and they were actually really excellent books in and of themselves. Now, they weren't obviously Rex Stout writing them, but I could certainly tell the difference but I still enjoyed, he still had the flavor and the character of the, I mean, the character was still there, and the mysteries were really that good. And I enjoyed
that. And some of, and no, and I agree, and I think the Sebastian Faulks Bond book, and there've been some good writers that have done them. I just personally think it's just a tough thing on the rest of the writing community if you're not just competing for shelf space.
Yes,
with,
yes.
You know, all the new writers that you've got to compete with, all the long dead ones.
Yeah, that's absolutely the truth. That's absolutely the truth. And it is a shame because there's, like we said before, there's a lot of writers that never get noticed and write great books and keep writing great books and still don't get noticed all that much. I mean, somebody knows they're there, but not enough people to become a New York Times bestseller or whatever, you know. And then there's others that
just need that little break, or, you know, but it's one of those, you know, it's one of those things, issues with the creative profession. You know, there are many famous painters that were never recognized in their own lifetime, and there have been writers that were very famous writers that were never recognized in their own lifetime and weren't discovered until after their death. You know, and so that's, you know,
and you look at
the nature of it, really.
What's interesting is you look at a book that, say, was published years and years ago, like Moby Dick or something, you try to read it today, it's not the same thing. I mean, it's boring. There's a lot of boring parts to Moby Dick. It's a long, drawn-out book, but it's a classic. It's considered a classic, and yet I defy you to try to sit and read it. You know, it's not easy to read.
That's true, and I think the mind, you know, we have changed, our tastes have changed. It's a bit like even when you're reading something like, even something like P.D. James, a novel now, you know, there was a style of crime novel written probably 30 or 40 years ago where, you know, you wouldn't actually get the murder until 200 pages in. You'd actually get introduced to all the characters before the murder. And most modern readers now, when it comes to the crime genre, they want their murder's got to be up front early. You know, they've got to be hooked. And I think partly that's due to the fact that we have so many competing sort of factors now, you know, for our time. You know, we have a limited amount of time, everyone has a limited amount of time, but you have, you know, obviously TV and DVD and cable TV and the internet, and every radio show and TV show and movie that you've ever missed is now available to you at the flick of a button. And so in the old days when there was nothing decent on TV, you'd pick up a book. Now there are so many other things you can do that it's got to be a pretty good book, and it's got to grab your attention very quickly, or you will simply put it down.
That just makes your job harder. Much harder.
It does.
And it makes what you do more remarkable that you're able to do that, that you're able to write books.
It does make it harder, because even someone like my dear old mum, who used to read a couple of books a week, has now sort of discovered there are so many other things she can do, whether it be playing Scrabble with her friends, you know, on the internet, or all sorts of other things. There's so many things that she can do, and she's not reading anywhere near as much as she used to. And this is why you have to survive and compete. You have to write something very compelling that grabs a reader's attention.
And look what they're doing. They're giving all these people that are writing blogs on the internet, they're giving them book contracts. I mean, it's amazing who is getting a book contract nowadays. It's like, I mean, it just blows the mind. I mean, Yale James, the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey, I think she started out writing blogs online, and look where she is today.
Yeah, she's writing, that's right, blogs or fan fiction and things like that, you know. But, you know, this is a way, another way people can be discovered. You know, there are, you know, the days when you could simply write the best book possible and send it off and have it published and hope that was going to be enough, that's sort of long gone now. You have to do social media and marketing and touring and interviews like this one, and do all we can to basically, you know, try to expand your reading base.
All right. Now, you said Close Your Eyes will be out when in the United States?
I think it's planned for February. Close Your Eyes will be out in February 2016.
Oh, wow.
I may be touring in the States in October. They're still making plans for, and that would be the possibly the paperback release of Life or Death.
Oh, really?
Be bought out to coincide with that, but I don't know. Don't hold me to that. I don't know the exact plans yet. And then after Close Your Eyes, we're going to see if we can't get the publishing schedules to match up around the world so that we don't have this delay.
Right now, where will you have no idea where you'll be touring for Life or Death? in the fall?
Not yet. I know that I'm going to BouchaCon, the crime convention, which is in North Carolina in Raleigh. That's in, I think it might be about the 11th of October or around that time.
Wow, cool.
And there are, as I say, not early plans. The discussions at the moment about doing an American tour either before or after, most likely after. So it'd be sort of late October. And I know in the past I've normally done the big crime bookstores in, you know, which is normally involved, you know, four or five states anyway, Texas and then the West Coast and, you know, LA and Seattle and San Diego and New York. And so they're on the east. And yeah, but I'm not sure. It may come off, it may not.
And one last thing, Stephen King calls you an absolute master. That's amazing. I mean, he doesn't call very many writers that.
He has been so, I've never met the man. I'm in awe of his talent. He is.
Wouldn't you like to meet him?
Storyteller since Charles Dickens. Oh, I'd love to meet him. You'd love to meet him. You know, he is the greatest storyteller since Charles Dickens. I mean, he is, he is the complete master. And it is so enormously flattering to know that I'd never met him. And it's funny. It happened several years ago when Chatter came out. He independently picked that book up and he wrote a piece in Entertainment Weekly magazine. And he called it his number one book of the summer. And I remember walking about 3 foot off the ground. I remember saying at the time that I could retire, that it wouldn't matter if I never sold another book. I could sit in my rocking chair in my dotage and tell my grandchildren that Stephen King had once,
Has he ever written to you?
Since then he's done that with Say You're Sorry. He called one of his top three books of the year. And then with Life or Death, gave it a remarkable for Life or Death, which is a huge honor.
Has he ever written to you or called you on the phone?
I know. I sent a message back to him after he gave he wrote about Life or Death, and I said to him that I would go to my writing desk with an extra spring in my step and the sparkle in my eye, and that I was just in complete awe of him, and I said he'd made my day, and he sent me a message back sort of saying, "I'm glad I made your day because you've made my year," and I thought, oh, what a lovely thing to say.
Wow, that is impressive. I bet a lot of people don't get that.
Yeah. That's the one nice thing about Stephen King is that that he doesn't do it very often. You know, he is very discerning with the books that he actually recommends to people, and so now I'm in awe.
But there's
But
there's a man who really enjoys reading. I mean, you know he does. Just from the things he writes about books, you know he really enjoys, as well as writing books, he enjoys reading books.
No, he does. And I think he's, he's got really wide tastes as well. I mean, it's not just, he doesn't read just sort of horror or thrillers or crime. He reads literary fiction. He reads, the latest must-have books and water cooler books and, incredibly well read, and he knows what he likes, and he's incredibly supportive of new writers coming through, which you really do. You want your masters and your established writers to promote other, the good up and coming ones, because that's going to allow the cream to rise to the top, hopefully.
It's been great to talk to you. We should let you go. It's been a long interview, and I've enjoyed every moment. You're really a fascinating man, even more than I expected. It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll take that as a backhanded compliment.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you all next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.